Shrink Wrap Radio number 695, Living Like Crazy with compassion-focused therapist Paul Gilbert, PhD.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My return guest today is UK Professor Paul Gilbert, PhD. Professor Gilbert is recognized as the founder of compassion-focused therapy, about which I interviewed him 3 years ago. Today, we'll be speaking about his book, Living Like Crazy. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Paul Gilbert, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
David, it's a great pleasure, and thank you so much for inviting me. We had a great time last time, so I'm delighted to be back again.
Yeah, well, I'm really glad to have you back again, because I have to tell you, you're back by popular demand. I was hearing from people who didn't realize that we had had that previous interview, and they're saying, you must interview Paul Gilbert. You must talk to him. And so...
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah. So here we are again, and your fame and magnetism is drawing more and more people your way. And so today we're going to be, and I think it was back in, I think it was 3 years ago that we spoke. I think it was in 2017.
Gosh, time flies, isn't it?
Oh boy, does it ever. So today we're going to be talking about your book. And it's the second edition of your book that's titled Living Like Crazy, a title which seems all too appropriate right now with this whole COVID-19 thing wasn't even happening then. I'm wondering how your second edition came about. You addressed that in the very beginning of the book, and I thought there was an interesting story. I got the impression it was kind of lying dormant in some way, and your daughter kind of got excited about it and helped you breathe new life into it. Tell us that story.
That's right. So in the 1980s, I'd been working a lot on motivation processes in relationship to mental health difficulties and wrote a book called Human Nature and Suffering. This was a little bit of a counteracting process to some of the cognitive approaches, arguing that the way in which our mind has evolved to compete and to be anxious and so forth can set us up for all kinds of mental health problems. So some of the reasons that we have mental health problems is partly to do with the way that the brain has evolved. And then after that, a couple of years later, I wanted to write the book on how culture can bring out the best or the worst in us. So we are potentially one of the most compassionate species. We have medicine, we've cured the world of smallpox, we do wonderful things, but also we are a species of extremes, because we are also one of the most vicious, nastiest, cruel species that have ever existed on this planet. If you think about the Roman games or the Holocaust or slavery, the tortures we've invented are just nightmarish terrors, really. So how come we can be these extremes, you know? So I started to write this book, which I called Living Like Crazy, to highlight the fact that a lot of the ways in which we have created our environments have good aspects to them, but also have driven us nuts, really, partly since the agricultural revolution, since of agriculture, where our groups started to get very big and we created hierarchies. And at the top of the hierarchies, typically there arose aggressive males. If you look at nearly all of the major civilizations, from the Vikings, the Romans, the Syrians, the Egyptians, they all basically had aggressive males at the top, supported by an underclass of henchmen, soldiers, secret police, armies, who kept them in position, and the rest of the population kind of struggled, you know. So the poor were always very poor. So agriculture created a completely different way in which the human brain had to operate, and it has basically driven us nuts. So that was then, and I sort of read that in the 90s, but then I got pulled away from that, had other books to write on depression stuff. And as you say, what happened was my daughter in about 2018 found this book on my hard disk where she was looking for something else and said, oh, can I publish this? You know, I've just set up a publishing business. Can I publish this? And I said, sure, yeah, why not? So that's how that came about. Otherwise, it wouldn't have ever seen the light of day.
That was great, because I got a nice note from her that she listens to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Yeah, she loves it, yeah.
Yeah, that gave me a big boost, big shot of adrenaline there. That's very exciting.
It's wonderful, Shrink Wrap Radio.
Yeah, so I have to say, given that you are, you know, noted as the founder of compassion-focused therapy, I initially found this book very dark, you know, because in fact you shine a light on the dark side of our nature that is so well documented, you know, throughout history. And I assume that your interest in compassion must have had some relationship to some involvement at some point in your life with Buddhism. Would I be right about that?
Oh, very much so, yeah. Very much
so. And what was the order of, in terms of your professional development, when did your interest in Buddhism begin?
Well, I was in the post-60s era, following the Beatles,
yeah,
the Maharishi, and Transcendental Meditation, and incense.
Sure.
And I used to go, you know, when I was at university, I used to like to go to the meditation groups, partly because a lot of young ladies used to go to the meditation groups. I kind of got into that then. But I got very interested in the issue of meditation. And then from there, I'm more interested in the Buddhist concepts behind meditation. Didn't do a huge amount, to be honest, over the years. And then gradually, in the mid-2000s, I met up with a Buddhist monk in a monastery and spent some time there, and got more deeply into the Mahayana traditions and mindfulness and other things. So I'd always had an interest, but it wasn't until about 2005, something like that, I really started to develop that interest with my own practice and so on.
Yeah, interesting. And I would guess that we're of about the same generation, and so the 60s were very important for me. I was in graduate school from the mid 60s on to 1970. And so a major milestone. Yeah. And so many of our generation who went into academia, who were youngsters in academia, went on to find ways to incorporate those early experiences and do the research and the science to kind of justify it in the Western academic tradition. And it's been great fun to me to interview people who are more or less my contemporaries and who in some ways followed a similar path. And so one of the things I thought I would ask you when we started out was, you know, well, what do you mean by living like crazy? But there was a passage in your book, if you will allow me to read from your book, that I thought just nailed it so well. And we'll get us off to a good start. And it also will give our audience a good sampling of your thinking and writing and the feeling for the book. Okay?
Yeah, wonderful. Thank
you. Okay. We are the inheritors of cultures that utilized slaves to build their power bases, waged horrific wars, and created social contexts of inequalities that we are in some ways still trapped within. We are all born to live in cultures that formed from complex histories. Every moment emerges from the preceding moment, to quote a Buddhist insight, you say. Therefore, we have to adopt the living practices of our culture, whether or not those living practices are conducive to our well-being. In fact, very little thought has been given to how to create societies that are conducive to human peacefulness and well-being. Rather, more is given to the military for weapons development and defense against other tribes, and to entrepreneurs to compete with each other in any way they wish, regardless of the damage they do to the environment and to us, who have to work for a living. It's difficult to look back on much of recent history and find societies that were specifically focused on improving the well-being of all. The Industrial Revolution, with its grimy, miserable, dark factories and mines, created places people would not choose to spend much of their lives in, but of course, they had no choice. At its core, This book is about how we have inadvertently created cultures that are in some ways grossly abnormal. Some of this abnormality is wonderful, for example, modern medicine, sanitation, and the ability in the West generally to enjoy freedom from famines, but a pandemic is not too dissimilar from a famine, I must note here, from famines. But some of it forces us to live in very crazy and destructive ways. Here, I will simply say that crazy is the way in which we are willfully destructive and use our intelligence harmfully and irrationally, close quote. So I just thought that really set up the framework for your book beautifully.
Thank you, David. That's great, yeah.
And then what you proceed to do in the book is to take a very deep dive. It ends up being a very scholarly book, I have to say. And you take a deep dive into history, social history, into philosophy, going back in some cases, 2,000 or more years, and into the evolution of Western science and psychology, and also particularly evolution. Looking at evolutionary psychiatry, you had some buddies that for years you hung out with who were evolutionary psychiatrists, and I guess they had a big influence on you.
Very much so.
And then I'm more familiar with evolutionary psychology, and I was wondering, is there a difference between the two, or is it pretty much synonymous?
It's very overlapping. Evolutionary psychology really is about evolution of a whole range of psychological processes, for example, how we form attachments to our children, our interest in certain sexual partners, and so on. Whereas evolutionary psychiatry is more about how evolution has created a mind that's vulnerable to mental health problems. Whereas evolutionary psychology doesn't specifically look at mental health problems, but evolutionary psychiatry is all about how evolved mechanisms make us vulnerable to mental health problems.
Yeah, and somewhere in this in your travels, your intellectual travels, you ended up devoting a good deal of attention to depression in particular.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Why was that? How did that come about? And what did you find out?
Well, I was very lucky because when I went off to do my PhD, I went to Edinburgh and worked on what is called a medical research council unit, and we had a ward, and we had a lot of the more difficult and complex cases, depressed cases from all over Scotland. And my professor said, look, just spend time on the ward, just talking to people, just go around and talk to people, and you're not trying to do therapy, you're just trying to find out their stories and get familiar with what it's like to experience depression. So that I did that for 2 years as well as doing a PhD. And of course, then a lot of the themes that were coming through from depressed people were feeling a failure, feeling worthless, feeling no point in life, wanting to escape, and so on. And so I was just very puzzled by why would our brains be capable of such misery? And so that was what partly set me off on trying to understand what are the evolved mechanisms for depression. And we now know there is about three or four of them, but in those days that wasn't so clear. So I became very interested in why the mind would throw individuals into such a terrible state of suffering where for them life just didn't seem worth living.
And I guess we've learned in more recent years that our brain is to some degree biased in a negative direction. And you agree that that's where
things are going? Yes, that's right. I mean, we tend to focus on the threats more than the positives.
And that there was survival value in that.
Yeah.
And that's why it's there, and why there are circuits in the brain and networks in the brain that seem to be heavily weighted, if you will, in that direction.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I've struggled with depression, I think, on and off most of my life. Never got hospitalized or anything, but have really felt that tug. As a matter of fact, there's some genetic history I discovered later when I discovered more about my family.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think the point, what's very difficult for humans to, for us to come to terms with is the fact there are mechanisms in our brain that will turn off positive emotions. And now one example, there's only one example, but if you are in a situation, if you're an animal in a situation where you get heavily defeated by a more powerful other, then you have to lose confidence. You can't afford to display confidence or show an interest in going after food or resources because the dominant will hit you. So the only way you're going to survive and in that group where you're vulnerable to downrank attack is to keep your head down.
Yeah.
Don't get too confident. And those are the mechanisms that get triggered in the brain when we get into depression. So they rather overdo it in the human case, and you get all of the same themes of being useless and a failure and no good and other people are better than me. All the themes associated with being a subordinate in a threatening environment, all of those themes are very common in depression. So that's why we suspect that the mechanisms that have been around for many millions of years that allow subordinates to survive and not get too injured by going hunkering down and, you know, being submissive, those mechanisms are the mechanisms that are getting triggered in some depressions.
Yeah, and I think you go on to speculate that that maybe that mechanism is involved in followership. There's leadership and followership, and that in the face of powerful governmental officials or powerful military people,
yes,
it kind of snaps us into that very extremely deferent. And you wrote about it. You didn't go on and on about it, but you wrote about it in a way that triggered me to remembering when I was a kid. And older, bigger, stronger kids would be pinned down. You know, they have their knees on my shoulders, and I'd be pinned, and that feeling is just terrible because you realize you can't do anything. You're helpless. You're totally subject to this other person, and so that's. We could call that an archetypal experience, maybe, because you write about archetypes. You know, surprise, your book is so wide-ranging, and so archetypes play an important role. Talk to us about archetypes.
Well, I think that's a brilliant example that you make, because what would have happened in that situation is that your fearful, subordinate, submissive defense would have been triggered. I mean, you probably don't remember trying to struggle to get up to fight, or you just wanted to escape from being injured, I would imagine. So that would have been triggered in you. Once it's been triggered, unfortunately, then we can become sensitized to it being triggered again.
Uh-huh.
So in situations where we feel vulnerable to be not physically pinned down, but that sense of being overwhelmed by more dominant, or getting into a conflict that we think we're going to lose, that can re-trigger those trauma memories and systems again. So that's pretty horrible for you, really.
Archetypes.
That's an archetypal experience in the sense that it's a capacity that's in all of us. So basically, what an archetype is, it's an inherited meaning-making system. So, for example, Jung talks about the hero archetype.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now George Lucas, who knew Joseph Campbell. Joseph Campbell wrote a book called The Hero with a Thousand Faces.
One of my favorite books. Taught out of it for many years.
Yeah, so that's archetypal. That's a process within all of us as we grow up, as we move into adolescence and so forth. We need to leave the family to go out and make our fortune, to face the challenges of the world, and so on.
And I thought in some ways you went beyond Jung away from those archetypes that we know from Joseph Campbell to a recognition that there are situations in life that we are confronted with, and they've just got something to do with the fact of being human, of the way we are social creatures and so on, that are likely to occur. We have to deal with the issues of life and death, with infirmity, and so on. And so there are archetypal elements to all of those kinds of things. Am I treating you properly here?
No, that's brilliant, David. That's absolutely correct. And they're archetypal because we all have to face them.
Yes.
Okay, all of us have to face the process of aging, the process of losing people we love, and preparing for our own departures. So these are human, universal experiences that all of us have to find some way of navigating. So yeah. that is exactly as you say, that's archetypal.
Yeah, yeah. And let's see, what else? So you say, you describe us as having a biosocial mind. Maybe you can expand that for us.
Well, what it means is that we have a whole range of biological systems that we obviously need to function. So these are systems which orientate the brain for threats or rewards or to find, pleasure in sex or whatever it is, or eating chocolate cakes or whatever. So there's a whole biology that's there for us. But socially, the social context shapes that biology. So we know that the environments that we grow up can even affect genetic expression. It's called epigenetics. So if you grow up in a very trusting environment, caring environment, you're much more likely to develop a trusting and caring orientation to other people, to be able to develop your friendships easily and so forth. And you develop your epigenetic profile facilitates that for you. So your brain grows that way. But if you grow up in an abusive, a hostile, frightening environment, then you don't need a brain like that. You need a very different type of brain to allow you to survive and prosper in a potentially hostile environment. And your certain genes will be turned on and off in you in order to build a brain that allows you to be much more threat sensitive, probably more impulsive, less emotionally regulated, less trusting. So this is where the social and the biology have a very close relationship, because we're needing to adapt our behaviors and our emotion regulation to the environment we're in. Okay. And then, of course, the psychological aspect is that we will then develop our beliefs and assumptions and ideas about the world according to how we experience the world. So if we grow up in a hostile, violent relationship, then we will have beliefs around that. I mean, as you probably read, we often say to our clients, look, we're only versions of ourselves. You know, if I had been kidnapped as a 3-day-old baby into a violent drug gang and I'd seen a lot of violence, I had violence on me, this version of Paul Gilbert wouldn't exist at all. A totally different version, a different genetic profile, different epigenetic profile, a different form of wiring in my brain, a very different version of Paul Gilbert. So, and I wouldn't have chosen to be kidnapped. So I wouldn't have chosen that version, but that would be a very different version of me.
Yeah.
And that's the biosocial bit, I think, that's so important for us to get hold of.
Yeah. What comes so clear in this book and in your writing is how complex we are. It's like systems within systems within systems. And it's not all in the brain. It's not all in how you were raised. It's not all in your, what else is there in your one of the things that you kind of fight against is the notion that mental illness, that model that we are sick somehow in the brain, it doesn't tell the whole story. It's not always helpful. And I think you put a lot more weight on the impact of child rearing, early experience, socialization, and all of that.
Yes, very much so. Very much so. I mean, I think when I was in Edinburgh in the 70s, you know, in the MRC, in the Medical Research Council, a lot of my colleagues there were all psychiatrists and physiologists. So they were doing a lot of work on the brain and receptors and drugs. And I was one of the psychologists saying, yes, but a lot of those physiological changes in the brain, they might well be caused because of social or psychological factors, you know. So we're trying to get these individuals to realize that actually these weren't diseases in that sense. They were the triggering of different states in the brain. So you could turn on and turn off systems in the brain according to the types of stress people were exposed to. And then a guy that you would have heard of, I'm sure, Martin Seligman, did his famous work on learned helplessness and showed that when you subject animals to stress over a period of time they cannot control, their levels of chemicals in their brain, like dopamine and the serotonin, they just gradually disappear. They go down, you know, they go down a lot. So these were examples where you could show these changes in brain state as a result of these psychologies. So I think for us, psychologists, it's very important that we don't get carried away by the fact that we can demonstrate major physiological changes in depression, which we can. Those physiological changes are associated with feeling absolutely terrible, being very anxious, feeling ill. A lot of the patients I used to see used to feel just ill. They had no energy. But that doesn't mean it's a disease. It can still be the triggering of a state because of overwhelming stress from childhood or wherever it is. And it's understanding how you can then, the point about therapy is how can you reactivate systems? How can you turn systems back on again? What therapies do we need to get the brain kick-started out of these depressed states? That's the key thing. Now, if you follow a disease model, the only thing that will do it will be drugs. Yeah. Because if you follow a psychological model, then psychological and social inputs can do it.
Yeah, so now we actually have evidence that psychotherapy is can change brains.
Yes, absolutely.
And, you know, whereas before it was a very strict separation that there were drugs and neurons and that was that world and that therapy was in no way related to all of that. But
absolutely. That's absolutely. Yeah. And that dualism was a real problem and it's still a problem to some degree in some circles. Yeah.
Yeah.
This isn't to say that some individuals are more genetically vulnerable. For example, bipolar disorders does have a genetic component to it, and that does produce swings in mood states and so forth. So it's complicated because it's not all psychology, but it's certainly not all biology either.
Yeah, and then there's gender, because earlier you were talking about the influence of males on history and our aggressive tendencies. One of the things you write about is shame. You write that shame is one of the most powerful, painful, and potentially destructive experiences known to humans.
Yeah.
So how does shame fit into living like crazy?
One of the things that's extremely important is for us to have a sense of social connectedness, sense of social belonging. It's very, very important that, I mean, there are some individuals who stand outside of that, like, you know, psychopaths or whatever, but mostly for most of us, you know, social belonging, having a sense of acceptance that people care about you and they value you is very important. And this was certainly very important in hunter-gatherers, because if you got shamed and shunned and got kicked out the group, that was basically a death sentence, because you just, you know, you wouldn't have survived on your own in the African jungles and so on, at least not for very long. So loss of social connectedness is a major threat. It's an archetypal threat to humans, right?
Yeah.
So the fear of being looked down on, being seen as inadequate or a failure or bad in some way, and wanting to be pushed away, there's a great fear, because when somebody is shamed, they have this great sense of disconnection, great sense of not being wanted, being pushed away by others, being the outcast, the reject, all of that stuff. So the experience of shame is very, very, very powerful. And there are two types of shame. There's three types, actually. Well, there's external shame, which is that, you know, I can feel shamed in your eyes, so you're looking down on me, and I can feel bad because you're looking down on me. But there's also the shame I do myself by being very self-critical and telling myself I'm a bad person and I'm no good and I'm a failure, and then that shames me. Now, the only thing shame will do is to make you feel bad. Shame will never excite you, encourage you, inspire you. Shame will always drag you down. Now people say, oh yeah, but don't think shame can be helpful, can't it stimulate you to try to change? Well, it can do that, but it's ideal that we change because we want to, we see the benefits of changing, not because we're frightened. So the key thing about change is that shame may alert you to the fact that you made errors or whatever, and to change your behavior. That might be one of its functions. But you've got to be able to then move out of a shame state, because if you can't move out of a shame state, if you just constantly get stuck in a shame state, then that can be very damaging.
Yeah. But what about, I was thinking about dogs and other animals that they look like maybe they're experiencing something like that, right? When the dog is rebuked, you know, hangs its head and won't look you in the eye, gets all hang dog. It's so that whole set of shame circuitry might be deep in our genetic inheritance.
Yes, absolutely right. It's a great point you make, because there you go again. That's where we go again into the submissive defense. Okay.
Yes.
So the submissive defense is to lower your eye, not to show any defiance, and show that you are now recognizing your lower status. And dogs do exactly that. They recognize that they've done something that makes them vulnerable to your attack. Uh-huh. It makes them vulnerable to your anger or whatever. So in order for them to deal with them having become vulnerable to being attacked by you, as a dominant dog, as it were, they then show this submissive behavior.
Yeah.
And then you say, no, it's okay. And you pat them on the head and you say, no, it's okay. And they like that.
Yeah.
So you reintegrate them by patting them on the head and stroking them. This is what ends the shame, because you then say, you're then showing them it's okay. You know, this is not going to be a problem between us. I'm not going to push you away. You know, uh-huh. I'm not going to attack you. We're all right.
Right.
And that relieves the anxiety and the joy. Yeah. We'll lick you again.
You refer to the big two kind of run through the book, which is caring / altruism, the positive side of human nature, I guess, versus contest / competition, that these are two sort of fundamental, I don't know whether to call them drives or what, but forces in the way that we organize ourselves internally and externally. And so a lot of the book documents the negative side. You really thoroughly document the ways that we're competitive and destructive and evil. And then you, towards the end of the book, you redeem us when you start going into compassion. But what do we know about the caring, altruistic side of ourselves? Is that as built in, as universal, say, as our angelic selves as universal as our devils?
Yes, and some people would say even more so, actually. Some people would say that actually, because we existed in hunter-gatherer societies for so long, where caring and sharing was the key to survival of all of us in those groups, we are by nature. This is what makes us happiest. We're happiest. Our cardiovascular systems, our immune system, our brain, all of these things work much better when we're in groups of people where we feel cared about, we feel valued, where we also feel we can make a contribution that is of value to them. This is very clear. Whereas when we're in environments which are hostile, competitive, backstabbing, this is not so good for our health at all.
Yeah.
And so the caring psychologies, the caring motivational systems are hugely beneficial to the human brain and body, actually.
Yeah.
So it's a motivational system that orientates how you pay attention. It orientates what you focus your thinking on, your behavior, and it orientates a whole range of physiological systems in your body. So we know that people who are very caring, for example, they have relatively good parasympathetic tone. You know, that's part of the autonomic nervous system. Whereas people who are very competitive, they tend to be much more in the sympathetic drive, you know, got to achieve, got to do, got to achieve, got to do system. So it's hugely different. These motivational systems have huge difference in a whole range of psychological and physiological processes going on within us.
You paint a picture in which seemingly almost by accident, but it can't be by accident, I don't think, but that we've ended up with political structures that are based around the masculine drive competition side of things, that side of the picture. And part of your argument is that it doesn't have to be that way, but it's historically that's how it's been. And so we assume that that's the full story of our nature.
Yes.
I mean, that's always been kind of a struggle. It's something I still struggle with, I think, in my own mind. You know, that I question whether utopia is possible, if there's something in human nature that makes a utopian vision impossible. What are your thoughts on that? Because you've studied sides quite a bit.
No, I think it's a brilliant point. It's an extremely important point because, as you would know, the Buddhists have really argued this all the way through, that a mind that doesn't know itself, doesn't really understand what drives it, it doesn't understand its archetypes, it doesn't understand the sources of its desires and impulses, a mind like that simply acts out whatever comes into mind. There is no steering of the ship, as it were. There's no choices about, am I going to do this, am I going to do that? And there's no guiding principle for deciding what you're going to do or what you're not going to do. So I think the key that the Buddhist position or the contemplative positions tells us is two things. Is firstly, let's understand our minds and what we're up against. And basically understanding that all of us are programmed. We're all programmed to behave in certain ways to pursue life tasks. And our programming gets influenced by the culture in which we grow. So, but we're all programmed. So like if I'd been kidnapped as a 3-day-old baby into a violent drug gang, I'd be living a different set of programs than I am today, but we are programmed. So the first thing is what they call mindful or mindful awareness or mind awareness of becoming aware that you have all this stuff in you. You didn't choose it, it's been built in there. You have a brain built for you, not by you. Nature's built this brain, right, to do different things, to survive and compete and have sex and rear children. This is all being built for us, right? So the key really is beginning to understand what's going on here, and then we can start to make choices. And the point about compassion is compassion then becomes the guiding light for you to choose how you're going to act in the world. So even if I feel aggressive, or even if I feel whatever it is, these things, rather than blaming and shaming myself or suppressing them, I acknowledge them, I accept them, but I don't act them out. So because I'm going to stick to a compassion orientation to life, I'm going to try to be helpful, not harmful. So I think part of the issue is the beginning of an awareness that we need to teach children about the nature of their mind. We've never done that. When I grew up, I don't know about you, David, but nobody taught me anything about how my mind works or how to regulate my emotions or why I would want to fancy Sally in the netball club. these things just arose in me. I didn't know anything about it. You're trying to work it out as you go, So training our children to understand their minds and training our children with compassion values, I think that is absolutely crucial for the generations to come. And that is beginning now to spread through the schools. We have a schools program, but mindfulness and compassion training, and that is a great hope, because when children understand these things, they're not going to be so taken over by the impulses and the things get stimulated within them. This is our great hope. So,
yeah. One of the things that's been heartening during this pandemic is to see the good side come out and express itself so widely, not universally, but these people who are singing to each other, making music despite social distancing, And we have grandchildren who produce just wonderful art, and you can find videos online of things that children and that other people are creating. And it's so heartening. It's so heartwarming to see this in the face of this big threat.
That's a wonderful point, isn't it? Because what it shows us is that all of us are yearning for connectedness. We have a yearning for this, right? That's very, very important. And the second thing is that actually, you know, compassion is not weak in any way. You think about all of the medics and the nurses and the doctors who are risking their lives to save us, right? They're putting their lives on the line. Firefighters or every day put their lives on the line to save us. Compassion is one of the most courageous motives known to humans, right? Because we will engage in suffering. We will put ourselves in harm's way to save others. We will do what we can to address other people's suffering. So it's a phenomenally important motivation, but it gets suppressed because we get caught up in our competitive, you know, needing a job, we want to earn money, and you need to all that stuff. So that competitive system can sometimes overlay this compassion. But what you're saying is so important, that when the conditions are right, we need to become compassionate. Not everybody, but most of us yearn for this connectedness, this caring and sharing of each other, this supporting of each other through the dark times. And even, as you say, in the case of our medical profession, you know, risking their lives to do it. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. So on the one hand, you've got this amazing outpouring of compassion. And yet, you know, just less than 100 years ago, we had the Holocaust and goodness knows what. So it's coming to terms with the fact we are a species of extremes. And it's coming to terms with the fact that we have to work out how we are going to address the dark side of the mind. And part of what living like crazy is to say, look, compassion is not stupid. Compassion is not naive. This is the dark side. And if we're going to develop a compassionate society and build on these wonderful things that are happening, it's not about let's just be nice and kind. It's about how do we address the dark side? Because it will try to emerge again. I mean, the right wing, the self-focus, the selfishness, the me first psychology, that will try to emerge again. So we have to find ways in which we have compassionate solutions for the dark side.
Yeah, the dark side. Listen to the force.
Exactly. I mean, George Lucas said it all, really, didn't he?
Yeah, you have to tap into that side. So yeah, I think there is this fundamental, there fundamentally is some kind of a struggle between light and dark.
It is, very much so,
Yeah.
And it's not to try to, you know, people will always compete and that's important. I think sport is a very good analogy, really, because the idea of sport is competing, but with respect, respectful competition, competing with the rules of the game and so forth.
Yeah.
What we have with Western capitalism is there's no respect. They're quite happy to destroy the environment. They're quite happy to go for tax havens and not pay their taxes and vote for governments that want lower taxes, not higher taxes. They don't want to share in their products of their wealth. So that's not respectful competing. So we're going to compete. Of course we are. You're not going to get rid of that. But we need to have much better refereeing. I mean, like with the banking crisis and so forth, lots and lots of economists have said our refereeing of competitive economics is bad, it's poor, it doesn't really exist. And that's part of the problem. So one of the things we have to do is to realize that if you don't referee, if you don't have strong rules in competition, people will cheat. And they do, you know, even strong rules, they take drugs to get advantage or whatever it is. So you have to have strong rules, you know. A strong police force is important for compassion. People think, how can that be? Because properly done, we don't want an aggressive police force, we want a respectful police force. They maintain the order, they make us all feel safe, because there's always going to be some individuals who will, unfortunately, try to exploit situations. That's just the way it is. So we can't be naive. There's no naivety in compassion. Compassion requires strong refereeing, respectfulness, and then we can compete.
Yeah. So who did you write this book for? What, when you said about writing it, what was the audience that you were picturing in your mind?
I think, yeah, it's a tricky question. It's very, very interesting. I mean, I remember an old economics lecture, because my first 2 years in economics, it was in the Second World War and had some wonderful stories to tell. And he always said, I like to write books because I never know what I think until I've written one. And then when I've written it, I can decide if I agree with it.
I could totally understand that point of view. I've had that experience myself, is that I'm so divided on, seems like, everything. I can always see the other side. That can be very paralyzing. But if I'm forced, if I've got a deadline or something, or even writing about these interviews and so on, I have to decide, well, what is it that I think? and the writing it down kind of forces me to put a stake in the ground.
That's right. And I think with these books, right, you're trying to put together, it's like a massive jigsaw puzzle, and you have to just sort of, by writing, you have to organize the chapters, and because, you know, I write about 10 pages for every page I publish, because I write it and I don't like it, write it and I don't like it. But it helps you organize quite a large array of information and ideas by writing them down, having to tell a story over 300 or 400 pages. So I partly write it to do that, but also I wanted to write a book which was very much about compassion is not a weakness. It's the strongest, most courageous motivation we have, because, look, you know, I'm a compassion therapist, but I can actually also address the dark side. Yeah. Compassion is not about being naive.
Yeah. And I think that's a central message behind the book and justification for it, because that is a major critique of people who are on the light side, is that they're soft, naive, don't see things with, don't really see reality clearly. That they're deluded, they're wearing pink sunglasses, whatever.
Yes, I mean, I think it's a brilliant point you made, because there is, there's the white middle classes who've got nice lives, and they take up compassion, and it's all about being happy and, you know, let's be nice and all that stuff. And that's great. I'm not against that. That's wonderful. But the reality of compassion to change the world, if you're going to change the world, then you need the courage to look at the dark side, because if you don't, the dark side will get you. And so as the Emperor said, Luke, you have no idea the power of the dark side. Yeah. Well, actually, we do, because we've had it for the last 5,000 years.
Yeah, it's been playing all over the world, stomping around.
So this is, I think for me, this is what part of what the book was about is, look, we've created environments where we spend so much money on weapons and working out ways of destroying and hurting each other and so on and so on, allowing the rich to just have, you know, about 9 families own, you know, half of the wealth of the world or whatever the figure is. We can't go on like this. We just simply can't. Yeah. So we have, but we're not quite sure what to do. I mean, everybody says, okay, look, this has been amazing. You know, people be singing to each other, a fantastic outpouring of a compassionate, desperate wish to come together for the benefit of others. Wonderful, wonderful. What we're not quite sure about is what's going to happen in a year's time, 2 years' time, right? When we do have the vaccine and we do go back to feeling okay. And it's finding the solutions to, in the politics and the business, in our own lives, for us to actually be aware that we will slip back into the shadows if we're not careful. So we just have to be aware, and we have to start building into our politics, into our businesses, into our schools, anti-dark side behaviors, basically.
So are you saying that this pandemic has a possible bright side in terms of presenting us with a pause, an opportunity to structure things differently?
Oh, very much so. I mean, you would never wish it, would you? But now that it's arrived, and now that we see what it's done, and now that we recognize just the wonderful, amazing courage of our medical staff, our, you know, fire services, the health, all the volunteers. I mean, you know, millions and millions and millions of people in your country, my country. just desperately trying to be helpful to other people. Once we see that we do have this potential, the next thing is, how do we actually make that part of how we organize our societies and our cultures? And we need to address the neoliberal agendas in the right wing, because they will pull us to the dark side, I'm afraid. So we just need to be honest about these things. And this is not against capitalism. It's more and more about actually understanding that if you don't regulate capitalism, you're going to have trouble. Mm-hmm. So it's just being sensible in a way. And one of the things I'm very interested in is, we've seen so much courage from our medical staff and so on and so on. We need the same courage in our politicians to address injustice. We need the same courage in our politicians to address vested interests. We need the same courage in our politicians to say we all have to build our medical services throughout the world. Because one of the things all humans should have is access to the best healthcare they can get. You shouldn't be able to buy it. Okay, so we need courageous politicians all over the world to actually fight for compassionate values. That's the issue, whether they will or whether they won't. And that, at the moment, we're not sure about.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have any reflections for people who about getting through this pandemic? You know, there are people out there that are very fearful, feeling isolated and so on.
Well, yes, I think the first thing is that although it's very, very difficult to tell, because the figures that are being thrown at you all the time are very, very tough, the evidence is, look, this, for most people who are not over a certain age, over 70 or whatever the age is, and don't have underlying health conditions, for most people, if you did get the virus, you would recover. And there are people, the other thing to focus on, there are people who are working, who will work to save you, who will risk their lives to save you. So this is a very important focus for us to recognize. We are also living in a world where there are all these amazing people who will do everything they can to save me. Rather than focusing on my fear, I focus on the compassion of others there to be helpful to me. Uh-huh. The next thing that you say, so this is focusing on, isn't this amazing? We've got these people out there they will try and help me as best they can. That changes the psychology. See, if I just focus on I'm frightened myself, me, that really locks you in your fear system. But if you think, yes, I am frightened about that, but just let me keep in my mind all these amazing, wonderful people who will be there to try to help me as best they can, that will change your orientation, you know. The second thing you ask is about how do we deal with loneliness, and this is such an important point. I think the key thing, as you say, is try to use whatever technologies you can. Try to find out if there are any groups around you who are involved in helping others, because one of the things that's important is the feeling that we're making a contribution. Mm-hmm. You know, some people say, it's not just that I'm lazy, it's not just that I'm lonely, but I feel just sitting here in myself, in my flat or whatever, I'm not doing anything. Who needs me? I'm not making a contribution. So try to find out from the internet or whatever if there's any groups around you who are delivering food packages or whatever it is, charities that you could get involved with. Get involved with a charity that's out there helping people, because that will help you feel better. You'll feel part of something, right? Yeah. So it's not just talking to friends and relationships. That's very important. But try to get involved with a voluntary organization or something like that. And then the other thing, of course, is using the time to develop whatever you know you want to do. So use the time to do a course online or learn a foreign language or whatever. Yeah. So there are lots of different processes, I think, but connectedness, wherever you have an opportunity to form a connectedness to other people, do try and do that as best you can.
That's a great message and a good place for us to move on into our lives. So Dr. Paul Gilbert, I really want to thank you for being my guest again on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's been a great pleasure, David, and thank you for your wonderful questions and opportunities to talk about these things.
In my opinion, Living Like Crazy by Professor Paul Gilbert is a very important book. It asks the question at its base, what is our human nature? Do we come into the world as a blank slate for experience to write our story, or do we come pre-bundled with built-in programs ready to unfold? Do we have free will or not? Is this a dog-eat-dog life of competition and struggle, not only to survive, but to surpass and dominate? Or do we come into this world with Eden-like innocence, only to be gradually corrupted by parents and society? Is there any basis for altruism and compassion for our fellow humans beyond disguised self-interest? Who among us has not grappled with these sorts of questions? Of course, the various religions of the world are happy to resolve our doubt and confusion with a mix of certainty and faith. Certainly, philosophers, theologists, scientists, and ordinary people have wrestled with these sorts of questions for centuries, millennia even. In this book, Dr. Gilbert reviews the best information we have from philosophers, psychiatrists, psychologists, historians, and biologists, among others, to answer the question of how we ended up living in such a crazy world. Why are we in a world in which social systems and governments, going all the way back, don't seem to broadly support human needs for community, safety, education, health, opportunity, gender equality, and so on? Dr. Gilbert suggests there is nothing in science that says it has to be that way. We got on that trajectory early on and have never created the structure to make it otherwise. Here in part is the quote from the preface of Living Like Crazy that I read out loud at the beginning of our interview. It literally speaks to the question, what does he mean by living like crazy? He writes, "We are the inheritors of cultures that utilized slaves to build their power bases, waged horrific wars, and created social contexts of inequalities that we are in some way still trapped within. At its core, this book is about how we have inadvertently created cultures that are in some ways grossly abnormal. Some of this abnormality is wonderful, for example, modern medicine, sanitation, and the ability in the West generally to enjoy freedom from famines, but some of it forces us to live in very crazy and destructive ways. Here I will simply say that crazy is the way in which we are willfully destructive and use our intelligence harmfully and irrationally." Close quote. This is a very scholarly book with tons of references and endnotes, yet a very readable one, which makes real sense of who we are and how we got here. As someone who's long been a champion for treating ourselves and others with compassion, Dr. Gilbert is laying the foundation for broad recognition of the better sides of our human nature. For too long, human nature has been tarred with the negative brush that paints us solely as greedy, acquisitive, competitive, aggressive, and so on. Those of us who experience ourselves as loving, peaceable, self-sacrificing, compassionate, and so on are too often accused of being weak and unrealistic, failing to see things as they really are. Yes, there is a dark side to human nature, but also a light side, and there's no reason for the dark side to prevail. After all, it's only logical to choose the light side for the good of us all.
Hi, Dave. This is Ofer calling from neighboring of Petaluma in Northern California, and I am the director of the Zur Institute, and I would like to share my deep, deep appreciation to your lively, informative, educational interviews. I want to let you know, not only we have used so many of them in our online courses for continuing education for mental health professionals, when I'm on the treadmill, I just put my Bluetooth and connect to any of your interview at random. And sometimes I find myself, oh my goodness, an hour later, I'm still on the treadmill. A treadmill because I am so engulfed and mesmerized and engaged with listening to your live interviews. So thank you for providing such a fantastic resource to therapists, to educators, to the general public. So I can't wait to hear your next interview. And as you know, I'm not giving compliments very easily. And you'll be the first one to know that. So this is really, real appreciation from the bottom of my heart. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Ofer Zur, founder of the Zur Institute, for your longtime support. Thanks to all our other ongoing financial donors. You know who you are. And thanks also to Paul Krauss and Mark Weisberg for their donations. I find myself once again in need of a volunteer who can help me get the word out about Shrink Wrap Radio on Instagram. There's an opportunity there to reach a whole different audience, and I'm looking for someone who is experienced in posting to Instagram. Now that Instagram has been acquired by Facebook, I'm looking for someone who would know how to link my interview clips that I post to my Facebook page onto Instagram. And with that, once again, we'll wrap it up for today. Thanks to return guest Paul Gilbert, PhD, for his extensive work on compassion-focused therapy and thoughts on his book, Living Like Crazy. Our next guest will be UK psychiatrist, philosopher, and author Neil Burton, MD, who will be interviewed by our Isabella Clark. Dr. Burton teaches at Oxford. So this is Dr. Dave saying, let's all shelter in during this time of crisis and do what we can to support one another.
I've been laying on this couch, babe. I've been laying here so long. Just waiting for Dr. Dave, babe, to play his shrink wrap radio song. Oh, he plays it so sweet and he plays it so warm. Shrink wrap radio, it's a harbor from the storm. You know he speaks to your mind, babe, but he's really speaking to your soul. Talking shrink wrap radio, babe. You know that's just the way that he rolls. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, babe, it's all in your mind. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.